Exhibition number 16808, Rule 34.
Reg Phipps, Rule 34.
Yeah, so one of the cases we had to deal with in a civilian court was concerned a British soldier who had apparently tried to have his way with this young German lady, you see, and it was a rather comical, it was to me anyway, because when they brought him in, you see, the situation, you have the civilian authorities who were sort of dealing with it, but the military were in charge of the case because of he was a soldier, and but the civilian court were going to sort of punish him, as you might say. Anyway, he was marched in, and he was a little tiny little chap with glasses, and he was either out of the Sappers or Pioneer Corps, if I recollect it, and he was about 5'2", and I should imagine he got tormented a lot with his friends in the unit because he looked that sort of a lad. And the case was read out and everything, and this is where Mr. Wolfe came in. He was the interpreter between the two civilians and the military, and I'm sitting there just watching the proceedings, and he got to the point where this young lady was brought in. Well, there was this little soldier about 5'2", and this girl looked like an all-in wrestler. She was massive, she was. Young, of course, but massive. And I thought, oh dear. Anyway, I brought her in, and the trial went on, and Mr. Wolfe was interpreting and all this, that, and everybody getting excited. And there was a woman there who looked as though she only wanted jackboots on and should have been in the SS. She was the defender for this, defending solicitor for this girl. I thought, good Lord, she only wanted a whip. Anyway, it went on, and the punishment was meted out, but apparently what had happened, I mean, normally you would have thought, well, that girl would never have even looked at this bloke, his physique and appearance. But of course, Germany, just after the war finished, was in dire straits, and the young ladies were quite willing to share the bodies for, you know, a suitable reward. And this is what had happened. He was on a promise, and when the crunch came, something happened that she didn't want to carry on through it. And of course, everybody used to have to carry the personal weapons. And I can imagine him going along with a dirty, great big Rolf, which were nearly as big as himself, with this big, large German girl, and threatening her that if she didn't do as she was told, he would shoot her, you see. And so this was the case that this girl, but something happened anyway. It appears he didn't have his way with her. And eventually the case was resolved and some punishment was meted out, which of course the military were going to deal with. But it was most comical, and I never forget it. Most humorous watching the difference in the physique of these two—the young lady and this soldier, poor, insignificant little chap. And but that was sort of an instance of some of the situations we used to deal with Mr. Wolfe. But prior to this, of course, as I said previously, I'd had two leaves, and we were married in 1941, and the wife always, we understood the wife said that she didn't want to have any children until after the war. And so precautions were taken, sort of thing, on leaves. And it wasn't until I got my first leave from Germany, and by which time I'd been away from home quite a while, and whether that was anything to do with it. But anyway, the result was that the wife found herself pregnant after I came back. And the second time, of course, when I had another leave before I was finally demobilised in 1946. And, of course, by then she was about 6 months pregnant and very much like a little mobile barrel. But, and to be honest, I thought I was a bit disgusted with myself because, not being boastful, but my wife was very good looking and everything, you know, everything is sort of you wanted in a woman, as it were. And I thought, crumbs, am I responsible for that? You know, she was terrific, she was like, you know. I said, you sure you're having one? Which she was. And strange enough, although the wife was very big, carrying in childbirth, the daughter was only 5¼ pounds when she was born. I thought she'd been about 8, but she wasn't. Anyway, the situation when we used to go on the leaves was quite complicated, really. The first time was all right, because Mr. Wolfe and myself, we went down in the car, you see. That was all right. But... The The first time we went down, and we went down by normal means, which was you travel by transport of any sort you could lay your hands on. And when you got down there, they had this system of colours. So when you got to England, you they used to give out notices on the radio, because in the Channel you can never rely on the weather. And they used to give notices out, and in the last 24 hours of your leave, you used to listen. At given times every day, there would be this warning that such and such a number, group and colour would delay for 12 hours or 24 hours, according to the shipping in the Channel, you see. And if you was one of those, then of course you had an extra day or 12 hours, so that they did get a congestion of personnel down at Dover, where you all went from at that time. It's like they hadn't got the hook to use yet, you see, and the hook of Holland. And people used to hang on, you see. Well, it was all right the first time, but the second time, we went down by the car and put it in the pound. I thought it was rather silly, because black market was very rife, and I thought, well, when we come back, there'll either be no wheels on it, or it'll be gone altogether, but apparently it was still there. But I got rather let down with Mr. Wolfe, because when we got to the end of the leave, and I was listening to the radio for these warnings coming out, and brought up till the last minute while I catch my train for London, no warning came through. So I caught the train, as expected, I travelled down to Euston, and Mr. Wolfe, of course, he was in London, and he was going to start the same time as me, but of course he'd get a train and he'd be straight down to Dover. Well, in the time that it took him to get down to Dover and caught the packet, that was all right. But in the period when I was travelling from Northampton to Dover, a warning came to delay for 24 hours. But that was no good to me, because I was already on the train, you see. And I didn't know about it until I actually got to Dover. But when I gets to Dover, of course they said, well, you can't travel because your group has been delayed 24 hours. So I was stuck at Dover for 24 hours, you see, overnight, and went over the next day. Well, when I gets over there, of course, no car. Mr. Wolfe had gone the day before. He missed this call, this delay, because he was closer to Dover than I was. And he'd taken the car and gone. So I thought, well, that's bloody handy, you know. I've got to get up to Germany. And there I was, stuck at Calais, with no means of transport. I mean, your travel warrant covered you for using any public transport. I mean, I didn't have to pay anything. But it was just a matter of, I got those, I don't know, 200 miles or whatever it was, to get from Calais up to Germany, up to Esselhard. Anyway, I started off, which was all right at the beginning, because there was public transport and all that sort of thing. But of course, the further you went, once you got, you might say, beyond Brussels area and up to there, the nearer you got to Germany, the worse the transport, the public transport situation was becoming. And you was having to rely on lifts, you know, thumbing lifts with the army transport or anything that came along, you see. But eventually, I finished up in this, like, it wasn't a castle, but it was a rather a large house, an appearance of fortifications of some sort, and a big gate into it, and an archway over the top. And of course, this was the end, towards the end of the year in 1945. So in Germany, by then, the winter had come on, and there was snow and it was cold. And I was at this place, and I'd got about probably 30 miles to go back to the base. It was just a bit too far. If it had been about 10 miles, I'd have walked it. But I mean, about 30 miles, I thought, well, I'm not walking that. So what we used to do, because it was so cold, we'd go to the gate and stand there for as long as you felt you could stand the cold sort of thing. And if it got too cold, you'd clear off back inside and go round to the canteen and get a cup of tea or something. And so you'd go out there and stand there, and every vehicle that came out, you'd ask them if they were going to use your route number, you see, because all the roads had route numbers, you see. And so your place would be Arnold, close to the side of one of these routes. So when these lorries and that came out, you put your own driver and pull over, and they say, you go route 46? And they'd say, no, mate. Say, right, thanks. Until you eventually got to one, and he'd say, yes. And then you'd say, how far are you going? Because I mean, he might only go just up the road. And if he was going far enough, then he'd give you a lift, you see. Which is ultimately what happened to me. I eventually cottoned on to someone who gave me a lift, close enough to Esslingen for me to say, well, that's good enough, you see, and I could walk the last couple of bits. And there was when I met a bloke named Dennis Ward from Blisworth, locally that was, an old terrier. The first time I met him was in Normandy, after he'd been posted, he went out to the Middle East and everything, and he took an opture and became an officer. He was a sergeant when he left us, and then the next time I saw him was in Normandy, and he was a lieutenant. And when I was coming out of hospital, returning to the regiment. And I was standing there, trying to catch a lift, and this jeep came up, you see. And as you probably know, the driver sits on the left-hand side, being it's an American vehicle. So the passenger is sitting on the right-hand side, and that's the side I was standing, because the lorries, being British lorries, the driver was sitting on the right-hand side, you see. But in this case, the passenger was sitting on my side, and I could see it was an officer, and without me asking, I wasn't going to ask him, you see, but he stopped, and he said, hello, Spittles, what are you doing then? And it was old Dennis Ward, you see, old Tush Ward, as we called him. And I looked, and he got a crown. He was a major. Since leaving Normandy, he was a lieutenant in Normandy, and now he was a major. And this was the way promotion came, because of the casualties in the fighting that took place, you see. Promotion was very rapid. And so he was a major. So he said, I said, good Lord, without thinking, I said, good Lord, how are you, Tush, you know? That surprise of meeting him, totally unexpected. He said, hey, what the bloody hell do you think this is on my shoulder, you see, pointing to his crown. And I was a corporal, so I said, well, that's about the same as what I've got on my shoulder. And I got two stripes. And his driver was sitting there wondering what was going on. And we had a bit of a natter, and of course off he went. And then I never saw him until after the war. We were both demobbed, and I did see him several times in Northampton. And I haven't seen him for some years, so I hope he's still alive somewhere. But there was just a little incident that happened that sort of brightened a miserable day, as it were. But eventually I get back to Esslingen and goes in the guard room, and all ready to have a moan because Mr. Wolfe had left me stranded at Calais. And I goes in, and this captain from the artillery said, oh, so I wonder when you'd turn up. He said, you know, you're 3 days overdue. So I said, yeah. I said, well, it wasn't my fault anyway. Nothing came of it. And I think I showed off a bit with Mr. Wolfe because he'd left me derelict, as it were. And that was that, you see. But it used to be funny how the leave worked out. And as I say, when it got to the end of your leave, you was listening for these delays that come out at the last minute. So you got an extra 24 hours at home. At, I was unlucky anyway. I should have had one, but I just missed it. And so, of course, I gets back. Well, then our life went on as usual, going out doing his job, different places and visiting different people. And eventually, of course, I was going to be demobbed. It wasn't too long after my second leave, actually, and the end of 1945. And so eventually, Mr. Wolfe and I parted company. And what they did, we were by now, we'd moved from Esslingen. We were in Detmold, actually. And that was on what they call Route 66. And of course, if you probably know your music, you'll find the Americans wrote a song about it, Route 66, because they have a famous route in America, which is Route 66. So it's a number that I've always remembered. And Detmold and Senelager and another place, which is well known, it became Detmold, and it became a training area for the British Army in peacetime after the war finished. And they talked to a lot of chaps who were called up just after the war. Whether they do with tanks or not, you find out that they did a lot of their training in that area around Senelager and Detmold. And Bielefeld, that was the other place. The three places, I think Detmold was the central one, and then you had Senelager sort of up to the left and Bielefeld down to the right, all on Route 66. And that's where we were when I was going to get demobbed, you see. And having said my farewells to Mr. Wolfe and all this, that and the other, what they'd actually done, there was a town, I don't think it was very far away, called Bad Oeynhausen. And what they did, they didn't want to build a camp, you know, because demobilisation wasn't going to be forever. And so what they did, they took an area of this town, like your mother said, an estate in the town, which was sort of defined itself easily to be separated from the rest of the town, and they fenced it off. And all the inhabitants in that area were then told to leave their homes. And obviously they couldn't clear everything out of the houses. So when we went in, most of the houses had still got furniture and personal stuff in them. And because what they did, apparently they were told to take whatever they could, which they did. They were then given a paper sort of thing that so they could come in and visit their house basically whenever they felt like it without being too much of a nuisance. And stuff that they couldn't take, they'd put into a particular room most of them had in the house so it could be secured. And then the rest of the house was used by the demobilisation people where they put some army double bumps in and things like that, you see. So they was using these houses and they just simply sectioned off a piece of the town and turned it into a demobilisation centre. At least a staging part. It wasn't where you didn't get demobbed there and go straight to England. It was just a staging post, really. But it was where I started. Well, I went into there and I was there for about 3 or 4 weeks before I moved on. And I piled up with another corporal from the tank regiment. And it appears we were the senior NCOs at the period that I was there. And they used to have to keep you occupied. They couldn't just leave you loafing about, you see. And entertainment was usual, what you made yourselves. And one of the entertainments we used to have, there was an elderly lady. And in her house, she got a big grand piano. And she used to come in 2 or 3 times a week to see that it was all right. And play it, you see. And she didn't play really classical music, but she used to play the popular classics, sort of the tunes that everybody knows the chorus to. They don't know the whole piece of music, and they don't even know what opera it belongs to, but it's popular to the general public, you know, they know the choruses. And that's the sort of stuff she used to play, which was quite entertaining, you see. So we used to get free entertainment that way, which was very nice, when this elderly lady came to keep her piano in tune. And anyway, they got to keep us occupied, and one of the things we did while we were there, this young officer came in, nothing to do with us, he just came in, and he said, I want you two corporals, he said, get a working party together, and he said, we're going to rig up a sort of a gymkhana. Because what was happening all over Germany after the war finished, as soon as they sort of settled down regiments into designated areas and they became sort of semi-permanent, it seemed that everybody was finding horses and tackle and creating these places for horses, you see. All the officers wanted to go all horsey, you see, in the spare time. And apparently this has happened, and this they wanted a working party to get out and fix the course up, you see. Well, me and this other corporal, we got a group of lads together, and we went out. This officer took us out to where he wanted, and he told us where he wanted the fences put in and all that. We even had to divert a stream to make a water jump for him. And well, we didn't know nothing about building fences for horses to jump over, like you see, and he didn't seem to have any idea, other than the fact that he'd been given the job of organising it. And he said, well, you just put a fence up and, you know, make it so high, you know, not too high, you see, because these horses, I don't suppose, are going to be really real jumping horses, hunters, like, you know, I mean, I think they're any horses they could lay their hands on, sort of thing. And so he left us to it, you see. So we got the lads going and we just simply built fences and then put this bracken and stuff in it, you know, and bits of out of the hedge and all that sort of thing until we thought, well, that looks like a jump. And that was that, you see. Well, eventually this went on for, oh, I suppose, 4 or 5 days, you know, because we weren't hurrying. I mean, there's no worry about it. It was just somewhere to occupy your time. And eventually it was ready. Well, then that was it, and we were carried on in the camp. And this officer came in again and he said, you'll have to go back, he said, and alter all those fences, he said. We've had a terrible time. And it appears that we'd made them too good and we'd made proper fences of them, you see. Well, when you see race meetings on the television, you notice that the fences are not real fences at all. There's only a little bit of a strength at the bottom, and then the rest of it is all this bric-a-brac stuff. And I mean, you see some of the horses almost run straight through them. There's no obstacle there at all. Well, we hadn't done it like that. We built proper fences, you see, and apparently on one of the times I used it, one of the horses went over, broke a leg on the top rail and had to shoot it. So of course we had to go back then, and somebody told us, explain what we should do, you see, and that was then that we had to take the top bar off lower it to about half the height anyway, by which the horse could almost just step over it. It didn't seem to me to be an obstacle at all. And build another fence the side of it. So there were two fences within about a foot of each other. And in that, you see, you could put all these branches and ferns and stuff. And so you got a sort of a double fence, which was about 2 feet high. And then all this stuff was stuck in, so it looked about 4.5 feet. But in fact, the other top was only sort of brushwood, you see, so it was really no obstacle, but it just looked like an obstacle. And that's what we had to do. We had to go back and do all these fences again, you see. But again, it was just something that we did, pass the time away, keep you occupied, and you know, like I used to say, keep your hands busy so your mind don't have time to work on other things. And then I remember we went into one town, and there was an American unit there. And what they were doing, this Americans, of course, they seemed to emphasise on luxury a lot, whereas the British force, as long as you got some biscuits and bully beef, it was all right. But with the Americans, they had to have all this fancy stuff and excessive amounts of food. So they created what I considered to be a large quantity of waste. And this unit, not having any facilities for disposing of it, they were dumping it into this sort of a small town it was, and they were just dumping it in one of the squares. And it was really revolting, you know. You sort of think how a war could bring people down to be so degraded as these Germans were. And it was the only time that I really felt sorry, because what had happened to them, they brought on themselves. And they were there, old men and women and children, and they got anything they got to put it in, and they were scrubbing around trying to scrounge sort of where somebody had a fried egg, and they just probably took the yolk out and chucked the rest in. And all over this square was all this discarded scrap, food scraps, and there they were scrounging in amongst it and foraging around to sort of get stuff that was still eatable. And there it was, just on the floor, on the cobbles in this place. And there they were, human beings, virtually grovelling to get this food to survive. You know, I thought, well, I'd say the only thing was, as I say, that they brought it on themselves. But at the same time, it sort of brought home to you how war can really bring the human being down to animal level, as it were. You know, they were really at the bottom of the heap. And never forgot it. But then,
what place was that?
I couldn't tell the name. It's while we was at Bad Oeynhausen in this camp. We were still there, and we went to this place for some reason. I can't even think the reason we was there, but it was something we'd gone to do to occupy our minds. But I always remember that incident. And we went to another place on doing a fatigue job, because that's what they were really, fatigue jobs. And I went round to the kitchens to see about organising food for the lads who we'd got the party, the working party. And I went in the kitchens, and it's funny how you remember these incidents that sort of have no bearing on anything particular, but the silly little things that you remember. And I remember going into the kitchens, and of course the main thing was for the German people to get themselves a job with the military so that they were secure. You know, they would get money or coupons or rations. They could begin to sort of have a sort of a secure life, whereas everybody else was scrounging and black marketing and everything else, you see. It was a sort of a survivor's world, as you might say. And if you didn't survive, then you just didn't. And so they were always looking to get work and employment to do with the military or the organisations, you see. And in the kitchens, of course, was all these women, Germans, who were doing all the jobs, you see, in the kitchen, cooking the food and preparing it. And I always remember this lady. I mean, I was 26, and she'd be about four in her 40s, so to me she seemed elderly, but of course she wasn't really. And it's strange, you remember, silly old thing, she was peeling potatoes, apples, peeling apples. And she hadn't got a machine, just got a knife. I'll never forget it, and because she was picking these apples up, holding the knife, dipping the knife into the skin, And without moving the right hand, she was spinning the apple round with the left hand, almost like a machine. And the skin never broke. It went round and round. It came out like a coiled spring. And she just flipped it to one side, took the apple into a bucket or a barrel or something, picked another apple up, just stuck the right hand, the knife, into the thing, and spun the apple round with the left hand. And it was like a machine. She never once, and I stood there watching, fascinated. And she never once broke one of the skins. It just went round and round and round like a machine. And there was the skin, coiled up like a spring. She topped it in there. God, I never remember anything like it, peeling these apples. It was wonderful. But anyway, time went on, and eventually it got to the point where we was going to be moved on and start the process of being demobilised, you see. And there was a chap somewhere locally, and he was making suitcases. And a civilian, and of course all these chaps, when they come in, you see, we got all our equipment, all fully equipped, and you got your personal things that you were going to take home, your souvenirs or whatever you'd screened, and things that you wanted to take home, things that mostly they were things that you probably couldn't get in England because of rationing and coupons, you see. And it became more apparent when you got down to Calais, as you're going to go onto the ferry, and then you saw in a mass all these accumulated things that people had got to take home, that they thought, well, that'll be handy in England because I won't be able to get one. And having been home on leaves, as most of them had, they knew the coupon situation and knew that it would only be worse when they got demobbed, you see, and became civilians and needed to live like a civilian and start to live in the world of coupons and rationing, which they wasn't doing while you're in the army, you see, because everything's found for you. And so they were accumulating all sorts of things to take home, useful things mostly, not just souvenirs to say I came from Germany, but practical things. And so they needed something, in most cases, to carry this stuff home in. And this chap, wherever he was making these suitcases, and he'd got a thriving little business going, so I acquired one. He just gave him a few cigarettes or something. He didn't give him money because money was useless. And everybody was going around with these suitcases, you see. Well, then, when you was going to leave Bad Oeynhausen, a quartermaster or someone of that type came round and he said, right, get your kit out. And they took away from you quantities of equipment, stuff that you would not need anymore, you see. But leaving you with the stuff that you would need at the next stage, because you were still not going to go straight down to Calais. You were going to go on to another holding station sort of thing. So at the first place, you lost so much of your equipment, because at that time you're supposed to have a full complement of gear, plus your own personal stuff which you were going to take home, you see. That didn't come into it. It was just the service stuff, you see. And he got a list and he said, right, I want so and so and so. He read out the list and you chuck that out on one side and it was ticked off to your name, and that was that. And then we went on to another camp from there, you see. But we'd been at Bad Oeynhausen for 3 or 4 weeks, actually. It seemed longer, the days sort of dragged on. And of course, when we got to the next one, we was only going to be there probably one night. But again, they took some kit away from you and you proceeded to the next one with less kit. And we made two stops before we got to Calais, after we left Bad Oeynhausen, you see. And in each case, we lost some equipment. We were gradually being scaled down, you see, to skeleton equipment. And I had a bit of luck at the last but one before I went into Calais, because we got there and we stayed overnight. And the first thing you do is find out where the naffy is and all that sort of thing, you see, and see what book she's going and all that. And there was a chap there, a corporal. The army seemed to have lots of corporals. And he was one of our yeomen. And he'd signed on for another 12 months or 2 years or something. And so he got a permanent job, you see. And he was running the stores. And of course, I got in the naffy and he comes in and I say, oh, Christ, you know, we got a friend talking and that, reminiscing. And he told me what job he was doing in the stores, you see. So I said, oh, you've got a tidy little number there, you see, cushy job like. And he said, are you going to keep your coat? And the thing was, the reason he asked me that was because when you're going to get demobbed, one of the things you handed in eventually would be your top coat. But if you felt you needed it or wanted to take it home, you paid £1 at the given time to keep it, you see. But if you didn't, then it was taken off you by the system of handing your kit in, you see. So by the time you got to be demobbed, all you got was an old fork and spoon type of thing, you see, and any of your souvenirs you was carrying. And he said, "How's your coat?" You see. So I said, "Oh," I said, I should pay £1, I said, "keep that, be handy for fishing," you see. I knew that I wouldn't have any sort of gear suitable to go fishing in the bad weather. And I mean, I got demobbed.